You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys for joining us so much. And this one has been long overdue. It's my favorite part of the program. We get to the interviews, and I'm sure you guys are probably sitting at home going, yeah, it's about time we don't have to sit there and listen to this guy drone on and on. Anyway, we're mixing it up. So we're getting somebody else here on the show that's been on many times with us, and I think it's fitting, considering what's going on, to get an update. And we are joined by Mr. Brent Johnson of Santiago Capital. Brent, thank you so much for joining us again. And how are things, man? Lots happened since the last time we had you on the show, huh?
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Always enjoy speaking with you. And I got to say, I am equally parts excited and just frustrated, as I'm sure many people are. I have had, in the last 5.5 to 6 months, I've had some of my best weeks and months of my career and some of my worst weeks and months of my career.
Same.
Or some of the most exciting and some of the most frustrating, however you want to define that. And so I'm happy to kind of go through both of those if you want, but it's certainly an interesting time to be in the markets. And, you know, I think you and I have talked about this before, is that you either love this or you don't, right? Or you either want to be here or you don't. And, you know, when things are going well, it's always great to be the fact that, you know, when you're ahead, it's great to be in the Super Bowl. And when you're losing, it's not as much fun. but if I had to choose, I prefer to be here as not be here. And I kind of feel like we're in the financial Super Bowl right now. So I'm happy to be here, I guess is the right way to say it.
Yeah, I want to get your kind of your 30,000 square foot view, but I will just tell you the road we have taken. So first of all, I've had my worst trading day of my life, my entire career during this run. I was down 7% in a single day. It's never happened before. And here's the kicker, Brent. I outperformed the market by 3% that day. So, yeah. But at one point during this whole deal, we were up 25% on the year in the S&P. As we sit today, I think we're about 1.5 up on the S&P. So it kind of tells you know, I went from feeling very good about ourselves, and we've had good, you know, I'm not complaining. We've done okay. But let's get into where we're at now. We had a Fed meeting today. We're recording the show on a Wednesday because I'm going to be out of town this week, and Brent's schedule demanded that. But Fed meeting day, but before we get into the Fed meeting, before we get into what they talked about and what's going to happen, why don't you give us your take, the dollar milkshake theory. For those of you just joining us for the first time, Brent's been talking about this for a couple years now, talking about how we'd see a dollar surge and how that would also feed into much higher equity prices. Where are we at on that? I noticed today the DXY is broke below 96. It hasn't been there for a long time, it feels like. Kind of give me the uptake on where we're at this year, what's going on, and where you see us at the moment.
Sure. Well, I think it might be helpful if I just kind of give you my rundown for the year so far and what we've seen and what we've done, and then I'll talk about, you know, what we do going forward. So if people remember back to December and early January, the consensus trade of the year was to be short the dollar and to be long EM and to be long commodities. And by about January 20th, that had been turned on its head, and the dollar started to strengthen, EM started to sell off, and we kind of understood what was happening. We thought that the dollar was going to get stronger, and we thought it would cause some global chaos. Now, I didn't think that it would be a virus that would cause that global that would cause the dollar to get stronger and would cause chaos. We just knew that the table was set so that if for whatever reason the dollar got stronger, it was going to cause a lot of problems, and that's exactly what happened. So we were hedged on our equities in January and February, and when we went into March, we actually added to them. And so we were down a little bit, into March, but not much, and certainly not compared to the, 30 to 40% that the overall equity indexes were down. And when we got really low, I had said ahead of time, I had kind of a target where I thought we would go. We went a little bit below where I thought we would, but, you know, we pulled all our hedges and we got long at the bottom, virtually, maybe a couple days early, but felt great about it. Felt great. Totally understood why we knew we were going to get a strong rebound. We got it. We were happy to be part of it. But as we went into it, about 3 or 4 weeks into this rally, it started to stall out. And the market went sideways from about mid-April to mid-May. And what I have always told people is that the rally, the reason long story short, when we hit that plateau, we re-hedged our portfolio. And the reason was, is we were rallying as part of a global reflation. This wasn't the milkshake trade that I've talked about before, where the dollar and equities rally together. And I think we're going to get into an environment where dollar and equity rallies together because the rest of the world goes into crisis as a result of the strong dollar. This wasn't that. This was rallying on global reflation, dollar weakness, and just Fed stimulus and Fed-related or government-related fiscal programs. And so I kind of felt like that was not the reason that I wanted to be long equities. And so we re-hedged our portfolio, you know, mid-May. And I got to tell you, the last 3 weeks have been some of the worst weeks of my life as far from a market standpoint, because, I mean, the market ran up another 10 or 15% and we were completely hedged and maybe even just a tiny bit net short. And so that's, you know, that hurts when that happens. You know, I could sit here and say, oh, things are great. And, you know, I always get everything right. But that's, you know, that's not the case. You know, I don't get everything right. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. But what I can tell you now is markets, all of the signals that I use to either say things are extremely oversold, it's time to get short or exit, or all the things that I use to say, you know, this is a time to get long, everything that was telling me to get short on equities or get hedged on equities in February are even at a higher level right now.
Yeah.
All the sentiment gauges, all the relative strength gauges, all the market signals I use are at a higher level now than they were when we were hedged in January and February. Now, does that mean the market's necessarily going to roll over? No, it doesn't. I'm just saying that the table is set for another drawdown. And here's what I think is happening. The reason that I think that the dollar has pulled, we knew that the dollar would pull back. We were prepared for the dollar to pull back. I even sent out a tweet saying, you know, it's at some point, you know, I think it was the day of the dollar high. I said at some point in the next week or so or the month, the Fed is going to do something, and it's going to knock the dollar back down. And when that happens, it's going to hurt. And so we're prepared for the dollar to pull back. Now, it's pulled back a little bit more than we thought, and this is why we think that that is happening. Part of the reason that the dollar spiked so much was because there's huge demand for dollars, and when the velocity of money went to zero due to the COVID crisis and no more travel, no more trade, dollars just didn't become available. So there was this huge dollar shortage. The dollar ran up. Now, since then, the Fed has come in with incredible stimulus. They've opened up swap lines with foreign central banks to provide dollar liquidity. And had they done that alone, then we think the dollar would have pulled back, but not to these levels. The reason we think it's pulled back to these levels is, in addition to that, what also happened was a number of deferred payments. And what I mean by that is, when trade stops, you know, the velocity of money stops, but also the money that you owe for the inventory that you ordered for China that hasn't been delivered yet because of trade has stopped, you don't pay that invoice yet, right? So there's a ton of cross-border invoice flows that haven't happened even though they're due. And so the fact that the payments have been deferred for cross-border flows, and then also because things you've seen where the IMF and China and even the U.S. have given some emerging market countries a deferral of the loan payments that they owe. Now they haven't forgiven them; they've just deferred them. So the dollar demand for those payments has been delayed. And then think about all the programs in the U.S. where, you know, people didn't have to pay their rent for 3 months, or they didn't have to make their mortgage payments for 3 months. I mean, I know several people who have called their bank and said, you know, we're going to defer our payments for 2 or 3 months. And the bank said, okay, no problem.
Yeah.
So what they've done is they've flooded the market with liquidity, and they've also deferred the payments that would have happened had they not done those deferrals. And so it's kind of like a double stimulus, for lack of a better word. So we understand what's happening. It's to one sense, it's frustrating. But the other side of it is that it's kind of exciting because the dollar's pulled back to levels that we think is not sustainable. And then also that some global asset prices, of which we want to short, have risen to levels that we don't think are sustainable. Now, so we kind of think that all the problems that we've talked about before have potentially been pushed down the road, but not a single one of them has been solved. Now, I do have to admit that it is possible that this gets deferred for even longer. Maybe they're able to keep the dollar weak, and maybe the dollar falls another, 5-10% over the next 6 months. I can't say that that's impossible. All I know is they have done nothing to actually fix the problem. They've only deferred it. So if that happens, I will hold up my hand and say, you know what? I got the timing on this trade completely wrong. But I'd rather be wrong by being early than just being completely wrong on what we thought would happen. Because what we thought would happen exactly happened. It just got deferred.
Yeah.
And so from that perspective, we still think that the dollar is the number one influencer of global asset prices going forward. If the dollar stays weak, then asset prices can rise. If the dollar doesn't stay weak, we're going to be right back where we were in March. And, the central banks will come out again and they'll do some other programs and they'll make some promises. So this isn't going to be a straight shot higher for the dollar. And perhaps it even goes lower in the short term. But I still very much believe in my milkshake thesis. I think that's still going to play out over the next 2 to 3 years. And I think the world is in for some more pain like we experienced in March. Now, that was a very long rant. I hope I didn't go too long. But that's kind of where I see things right now.
No, you know what, buddy? It wasn't really that long. We've had longer. I've said before, this is a rant enabled zone. So I like to get people going. Now, I see it virtually. It's funny to listen to you do a rundown for the year because we've communicated some during this, but not a lot. And it sounds like you're describing my book. We hedged up again during that period of time because you're sitting there going, okay, this is the. I mean, there's no question about it. It's the fastest, biggest retracement of a loss of that size in market history. I mean, I don't think there's anything that comps to it. It's broken all the rules. And I agree with you that I think the dollar, for the people that dismiss it, you're not going to convince everybody, but it's really hard to argue with the idea that the dollar is the heavyweight in the room. And pull up a chart of the S&P and look at the dollar movements versus the market over the last, 3 months. I mean, you'll see it plain as day. Where do we go, though, as far as now pulling back from the macro side of it and focusing on the dollar? I want to get back into that. But where Brent, I'm looking at markets right now that in my career I have never seen, including the tech bubble. People think back, and the valuations have set a new all-time high virtually on every different metric. We're in undiscovered territory across the board. And we go, oh, yeah, it's much like 99, but, it's different this time. There's a little difference, though. We look back, and GDP growth in 1999 was 4.1%. The Fed came out today in their meetings today, and they said they expect a 6.5% drop to GDP.
Yep.
I think that's ridiculously conservative. I think the number is going to be more like 10 to 12. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. But when you've got a market like this that is clearly disconnected from reality, just the intraday movements, right, of different stocks, different assets, it's completely disjointed. Do we sort of take, and with your dollar thesis in mind, too, do we sort of sit there and pull the analyst move right now, which is, hey, let's throw 2020 out the door? And I think that's laughable on a valuation basis, and I think you'd agree with me. But in terms of the dollar play, there is so much central bank interference and involvement here. Do you think the dollar really even has the ability to do that in this environment, when so many other things, you know what I mean? When Fed's burning up 16 swap lines right now, flooding the market with it, is it almost like, hey, let's put this on hold and wait for this blitzkrieg of cash to calm down, or can it still shine through? I mean, where are we at as far as the markets and how that's impacting the whole dollar thing?
Sure. So going back to what I said earlier about equity markets, and I should say valuations, I agree valuations are high. And I hate saying that valuations don't matter, but I honestly believe over the next couple of years, valuations ain't really going to matter.
Well, they clearly now, don't in the long right term, now.
Right. But I can kind of tell you why they don't now. And I would say that I am not adding to equities right now. I'm frustrated as hell that I missed this run. because I understand exactly why the run's happening. It actually goes to a lot of work that a friend of mine, Mike Green of Logica Advisors, and if you've never spoken to Mike Green, you definitely should. He has done a ton of work on the rise of passive and the influence that passive investing has on market structure. Yeah. And I'm not going to butcher Mike's analysis, and he's 10 times smarter on this stuff than I could ever hope to be. So I don't want to speak for him. But in very simplified terms, he has a very sophisticated way of explaining that the market structure right now is basically the simplest algorithm in the world. If there's cash in the account, you buy. It has nothing to do with valuations. It has nothing to do with management teams. It doesn't matter what the balance sheets look like. If there's a cash in the account, you buy. And if somebody asks for money back, you sell. And they become self-reinforcing. When markets go up and more cash comes in, you buy more, and it encourages more people to come in, and it becomes like a vicious cycle to the upside. The same thing that took the market down in February and March is exactly what has taken it back up in April through June. A lot of liquidity hit the accounts, and we can go through where that liquidity came from. The simple algorithm said buy, and yeah. It just pushed the markets to extremes. Now, the only way that I think that equities can continue materially higher from here is if we get into the heart of my milkshake theory, where the rest of the world starts to break down. People sell out of foreign assets because they're afraid of, you know, owning government bonds of India or Turkey or whoever it is, Brazil, and they search for that global safety of U.S. equities. Now, I know that sounds funny to say safety of U.S. equities, but on a relative basis, I think they are.
Yeah.
But barring that happening, I don't think we go materially higher from equities here. I think what will happen is that we will get another pullback in sometime in the next, I don't know, couple weeks or couple months. I don't know if we'll go back down to those levels of March. It seems unlikely considering all that the central banks are doing, but it's still possible. When the economy opens back up and when those deferred payments have to be starting made again and all of these, you know, commercial real estate loans have to be paid and that can't be paid and all these malls where the retailers are going bankrupt don't make their payments, you were going to move along from the liquidity crisis that we had in March to the solvency crisis that we're going to have sometime in the next 6 to 12 months. And when that happens, I think we're going to have another down leg in equities. And I think when the next move up in the dollar, I think equities will fall again. But after that initial fall in equities, if we start to get this volatility around the world and in these emerging markets and we start to get this contagion that I see coming, then I think we're going to get into an environment where the dollar and U.S. equities rise together. And so we're not there yet. I still think it's coming. Maybe it's delayed a little bit longer than I thought it would be, but that's kind of how I see it.
Okay, here's an interesting question. Now, I didn't have this on my sheet of things that I want to talk with you, but it's something that, and I'm very familiar with Mike Green's work, and funny enough, I actually might have to ask you to connect us because I've been wanting to have him on to discuss this.
Yeah, because happy to do it.
Well, and I think it's so prescient, Brent, because it is technical and it's high level, but this show is aimed at, right, we're on radio, so we're aimed at, you know, retail investors.
Yep.
How are the vast majority of retail investors invested, right? ETFs.
Yep.
So I just feel like it's very topical. One of the things that I've been thinking about, and this is something that I've been slow to recognize because, you know, there's the way that we've always done it, money managers. There's egos involved. All of us have them. We believe in doing things a certain way. Part of me wonders at this point whether stock picking in this market really makes a lot of sense or whether you should just ride the indexes at this point. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's a very good question. And the answer, I would say, it kind of depends on who you are and where you're at. And what I mean by that is it depends on the index and it depends on what you're trying to do. If you're a U.S. investor and you're just trying to ride the wave, I largely think that just either buying the big blue chip U.S. equities or the indexes is the way to go.
Yeah.
I don't know that it, I mean, listen, I could be very wrong on this. I don't think, I personally am not going to get a lot out of it doing additional, analysis on the balance sheet and the management team and et cetera, because I don't think we're in a value environment right now, right? Now, that doesn't mean that, I don't think that, there's nothing wrong with doing that. If that's your forte and that's what you really want to do and that's what you're good at, then absolutely do it. I just don't know that it makes that big of a difference right now. I think the structural issues of the market and market liquidity kind of override that right now.
Well, I mean, just to your point, right, the best performing stocks over the last 2 weeks is everything that's bankrupt. I mean, that's right. I mean, that's the market, right?
Right.
And this is one of the things that we've really been thinking about, because I got to tell you, we got some things that we love in the portfolio, companies that we think are deeply undervalued that are actually doing well, even in this environment, right?
Yep.
We've had some big winners in there, but in general, watching the movements, they're completely disjointed from reality. They're as disjointed from reality on one side of it as Hertz is on the other side, right? Or Nikola, the new, you know, the Tesla. I mean, and it makes sense, right? You're sitting there going, okay, if I'm sitting there saying that reason and traditional value metrics are broken down, you know, why do you keep going to that well? That's something that we've been talking about internally, saying, hey, maybe we need to pull back on the value approach until some semblance of normalcy comes back into this market, because it, you know, it's clearly not there.
Well, I think a little bit on that, and this is my opinion, and feel free to tell me that I'm crazy here, but, you know, in the long run, value is going to outperform. It just will, right? It just will. But if you're a value investor, you've kind of got to be a little bit okay with being a contrarian and trailing. If you're okay being a value investor and you don't mind trailing the market in a crazy environment like we're at right now, then just be a value investor, right?
Yeah.
But if you lose clients because you're being a value investor, you know, then I think you've either got to get new clients who match your investment style, or you got to consider whether that's the type of investment you want to do. Like, I think long-term value is always going to make money, but there may be periods of time where it doesn't. So I think it's really a matter of matching your personal style to your clients. You know, one of the most important things that I always talk to new people who are coming into this business that you and I are in is, the most important thing, in my opinion, is picking your clients.
Yes.
Don't accept a client who is trying to beat the S&P 500 every single year if you don't use the S&P 500 as your benchmark. You're putting yourself behind the eight ball at the very beginning.
Yeah, or the one that I've learned too is the client you, and I don't care how big their account is, the client you have to avoid is the one that says, I don't want to get wiped out, but then measures you against the S&P every year. Right.
No, exactly.
Like, are you kidding me? You want me to beat the S&P every year, you got to be able to look me in the eye and tell me you're okay with 40% drawdowns.
Exactly.
You know? And if you can't stomach that, then let's not even leave the dock. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So getting on now, one thing I want to talk about, and part of it is because I'm going to sit here and without any shame, I am going to milk you for information, because I did not see the Fed meeting. I was in a meeting.
Okay.
What, anything in particular? I mean, I did see the highlight about their 6.5% GDP forecast. You can feel free to disagree with me. I just laughed when I saw it because I just said, good luck. What did they discuss? Anything of note of interest that caught your eye?
Well, I read the statement. I listened to about the first 30, maybe 35 minutes of Powell's press conference, and then I'd had enough and I left. So if he said something in the next 15 or 20 minutes that was even more provocative than what I'll tell you, then, you know, I missed that. But the main line that jumped out at me, somebody actually even sent it to me on Twitter. He said, we are not even thinking about raising interest rates. So that kind of jumped out. And then the other thing that it just shows you how these central bankers think. Early on in the speech, he said, listen, we cannot spend money. That's up to the fiscal side. That's up to Congress. All we can do is influence policy to make loans and credit more available. So that's how he's trying to solve this problem, with more loans and credit. Now, later in the speech, he says, currently, investors are struggling to make their payments on their loan and credit. So we've had to make these deferral programs so that these payments don't have to be made, are a big help right now. So I'm thinking, okay, you acknowledge that people can't even make payments on the loans of which they currently have, but you're going to fix this by giving more loans. And, you know, part of me does, I get kind of tired of the financial justice warriors who come on and rail at the Fed. Because the fact is, it doesn't matter. We can yell all we want. This is what they're going to do. This is what central banks are designed for. So to think that they're not going to do something is silly. But it doesn't mean you have to agree with them, right? So it's important to listen to what they say and try to figure out how that's going to affect asset prices. But if you're going to try to get me to say that the Fed said something smart, it's going to be a long, it's going to be a very long pause in the conversation.
Yeah, and some awkward silences with a clueless stare right in your, your eyes. Yeah. No, yeah. I'm with you, and I rail on the Fed. One of the primary reasons I rail on the Fed is, again, educating our listener base.
Sure.
About it. But I've come to the same conclusion as, hey, take it out of your mind, because it's here's the other thing, and you and I both know this, which is every single action, if you're getting sick and tired of them at this point, you just wait for the next 3 years. Because
absolutely.
Right? Every action they take ensures another action. They have to.
Absolutely.
They just dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and then the economy becomes more dependent on their interest rate manipulation and their printed money. The thing that I do think is funny is we can't buy anything, and I'm sitting there to myself thinking, well, tell that to the corporate bond market. Right. Because, you can't do it. The Treasury does it, but via a special purpose vehicle that you guys funded. It's just, man, we're at a place where, again, I quote myself, Brent, because nobody else is going to do it. So I said on a previous show that we'd cross the event horizon into madness. And
right.
We were flirting it with there for a while, a long time. Now it's just unadulterated, just off the chain. And like you said, here's the other thing, to be fair to the Fed. They can't stop.
No.
Right? They stop, the whole bloody thing comes apart.
Right. So to think that they're, and this actually kind of leads into something else. What you just said, it touches on that as well as what you were just talking about a couple minutes ago, is that, it's one thing to be upset personally about what the Fed is doing, but it's important not to let your personal opinion affect what you would like to see happen versus what is actually going to happen. So let me give you a good example, and I'll touch on gold because I know a lot of people want to hear what I have to say on gold, and I've got to jump in about 5 minutes. But this will explain a lot of my position on gold for the last year. It's well known that I have been a gold bug forever. I think the gold should be part of everybody's portfolio. I think it's going to go to $5,000, and it should be the bedrock of a personal investment portfolio. However, I've been saying since 2016, it wasn't going to break out yet. And a lot of my friends in the gold world didn't like me saying that, would give me a hard time for it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that held pretty well until last summer, about a year ago exactly. And, a year ago exactly, the gold was around 1,300, and now it's at 1,700, right? Yeah. And so it's had a huge run. Now, people kept saying all through last year, it's broken out. Why don't you get back in? First of all, I never got out. I just said I wouldn't add to it here. The second thing, though, is I kept saying when the dollar spikes, I think that we could see some weakness in gold in the gold miners. Well, that's exactly what happened in March.
Yeah.
Again, I personally would love it if we had a free market, gold was money, and we didn't have to deal with, the debasement by central banks. But we do. And so, I would very much prefer that gold rose in value and it re-exerted itself in the center of the monetary system. But I also know that central banks aren't just going to let that happen. Monetary authorities aren't just going to let that happen. And until the rest of the world agrees with me and the other gold bugs, gold's not going to do that. And so it turned out that when we had this liquidity crisis in March and the dollar rose, gold went from 1650 back to 1450. The miners went from being near their 2 or 3 year highs all the way back below where they were a year ago.
Yeah, GDX got down to 1650. Yeah.
And so that was my point, is that it wasn't that people shouldn't own gold. It's not that they shouldn't own some of these miners. It's just that you need to understand the way the monetary system works. If we get a spike in the dollar, people will look for liquidity wherever they can. And that can come from gold or the miners. And so, for the people who didn't buy last summer, they had a great opportunity to buy again, a couple months ago. And will we get that event again? I don't know. Maybe we don't. Maybe that was it for gold. Now maybe we're back to the races. But I still think that we're going to have more dollar spikes. And so I still think we're going to get more opportunities to buy gold rather than at 1700. So anyway, I don't know if that kind of relates to what we were talking about or not, but I think it's kind of, it's important to understand how the world works. It's important to understand your personal philosophy, but it's also important to separate your personal opinion from what's actually going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Or your personal preferences. I should say, you know, differentiate your personal preferences from what's actually going to happen.
Yeah. No, I think if you do this job for any long period of time, it's you know, have your own outlook and have your own view, but also leave what you want. Or I think it was Jared Dillon. He had an interview on Real Vision that I thought he was dead on, which is, you know, people are sitting out griping about the central banks, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And look, I will plead guilty to an extent.
Yep.
We bought some stuff at or near the lows.
Yep.
In hindsight, nowhere near as much as we should have.
Yep.
And he's 100% right. Our job is to make money and not lose it. And
right.
If the central banks are juicing it, and that's going to drive up equity prices, which it's worked for the last 12 years, at some point that's going to break. But you and I know that there are, you know, there's relatively simple risk mitigation, you know, things that you can do to make sure, you know, yeah, you might take the 8-10% hit, but you're not going to get wiped out. And
right.
You got to play that game. Now, one of the things we had, funny enough, we don't do this often, man, but we had zero gold exposure going into March on purpose.
Yep.
And we were eyeing that 32 level on GDX. If we broke above it, we were going to buy. It never
yep.
did, really. It flirted with it.
Yep.
And we waited. Thank goodness we did, because
yep.
we got a wonderful buying opportunity that we took full advantage of. Now, here's the
That's
one
great.
Thing. So we've gotten a – well, I just wish it would have been a bigger weight in the portfolio, right?
Sure.
So the thing that I'm looking at right now, though, is that that position has performed well for us, obviously. But here's the thing. You can't get a better narrative for gold than where we're currently at. If you told me that the Fed was going to take the actions that they took, I would expect gold to have catapulted and be flirting with 2,000 right now. It hasn't done that.
Yep.
What do we – it's not going to get much frothier for gold in terms of
– Well, so – Yeah, and so I know exactly where you're going, and I'm going to address this question, and then I've unfortunately got to jump because I've got another call in 3 minutes. But I think that if gold does not definitively break through here in the next, call it, few weeks or few months, then we're probably going to have some more weakness in the fall. Now, can I be wrong? Of course. Am I telling you to sell your gold? No, I'm not telling you to sell your gold. I'm just saying that, to your point, this is the perfect environment for gold. If it doesn't do well here, it's, you know, it's probably due for a pullback.
Yeah.
Part of the reason I think that gold has it may pull back is I think we're going to get another run in the dollar. I think, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean gold will go down if the dollar goes up, but it's a headwind, right?
Yep.
The other thing is that with inflation expectations falling, that actually makes real rates rise. Because when you calculate real rates, you take interest rate minus the inflation rate. But when you're minusing a negative, you're actually adding. So real rates are actually rising right now, and that is a headwind for gold. Now, does it mean that gold can't go up? No, of course it doesn't. Of course gold could go up. But I'm just saying there are some headwinds for gold that need to be thought about. And so, you know, I own gold. I used to continue to think that you should have it in your portfolio. I am not yet convinced that we're running to the all-time highs. You know, you look at the miners, they're still below where they were, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, despite the fact, you know, so... You know, there's a lot of room to run higher, but, you know, the fact that it's not higher, that's also a signal itself as well. So I guess I'll just leave it and say I think everybody should own gold, but, you know, be prepared for some pain along the way.
All right, pal. Well, hey, I thank you for making time, and let's try to do this again when we both have a little more time. I'm leaving town, so we had to squeeze this in, but best of luck to you. Appreciate your thoughts as always, and people can follow you at Santiago Capital, right? Or no, Santiago.
It's at Santiago AU Fund, AUFUND, or you can just email me at Brent@SantiagoCapital.com.
Yep. All right, buddy. Well, hey, cool. Thank you so much. Have a great week, and we'll catch back
you
up
too.
With you soon.
Sounds good, man.
All right,
thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham now at knowyourriskradio.com. Zach will be back with more Know Your Risk Radio next Saturday at noon on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.